seemed that he burst on the scene just as COVID emerged in March of 2020. Dr. Fauci has been a leading public health and infectious disease voice and expert for more than 35 years. He was appointed to director of the National Institute for Allergy and Infectious Disease at the National Institutes of Health in 1984. In this role, he has advised five presidents. He led the nation in its medical and public health response to HIV/AIDS. He helped develop the president's emergency plan for AIDS relief, PEPFAR, which has saved millions of lives. He also played a critical role in the response to the anthrax attacks, several Ebola outbreaks, the emergence of bird flu, developing a universal flu vaccine, just to name a few. So it is absolutely no wonder that presidents have turned to Dr. Fauci for his advice and guidance. It is my pleasure then to welcome Dr. Fauci back to the National Press Club. The floor is yours.
Thank you very much. It's really a pleasure to be with you again. And I'm happy to make this presentation about the challenge that we're facing. And as you can see from this first slide, I've indicated it that it's the lessons learned and remaining challenges. So I understand I have to ask you to go to the next slide. So we're going to go through quickly. These are the six elements that I'm going to be talking about. Next slide. The first is epidemiology. Next slide. And as you know, we went, as was just mentioned, from virtually no cases at all in January of 2020 to now. This has emerged as the most important and impactful pandemic of respiratory disease in well over 100 years, with about 275 million cases and over 5 million deaths globally. Next slide. In the United States, as can be seen, that we are one of the handful of countries that was hit the hardest with this, with now over 50 million cases. And just last week, we passed that very terrible landmark of over 800,000 deaths. Next slide. This has been most extraordinary, not only in the United States, but throughout the world, in having multiple major surges, as shown schematically on the slide here. And if one goes to the far right-hand part of the slide, you see we were in a late summer surge of 2021, came down, but to a baseline that was unacceptably high. And over the past several weeks, beginning in the end of October and the beginning of November, we are now on an upsurge of Delta. And I'll get to that in a moment. We have not yet seen the full impact of the very ominous Omicron variant. Next slide. Let's take a quick look at the virology. Next slide. As you can see here, this is a beta coronavirus, an RNA virus that has four structural gene proteins, the most important of which is the S or spike protein with its receptor binding domain, which binds to the ACE2 receptor on cells in various organs of the body, particularly the upper and lower airway, the GI tract, cardiovascular, and other tissue. Next slide. With regard to transmission, we know an awful lot about its transmissibility now because of our 2 years of experience. It's transmitted by the respiratory route, not only respiratory droplets, but also, as we've learned very clearly over the past year, by aerosol particles, with the deposition of these particles on mucous membranes. Contrary to what was thought early in the outbreak, there is much, much less transmission through contact with contaminated surfaces. In fact, very few, if any, documented cases of transmission solely by that means alone. The risk is greatest in areas with poor ventilation, but also with behaviors such as exercise, hence the danger in gymnasiums, singing, hence the danger in choirs and choruses, as well as prolonged indoor exposure. Next slide. With regard to the epidemiology and the spread, there are some very unique aspects of this particular virus. One, at least a third and maybe 40% of all patients who develop this infection never develop symptoms at all. Extremely unusual for a virus that has the capability of killing 800,000 people in the United States. Next slide. Another unique aspect is that about 60% of all transmissions occur from someone who has no symptoms, either someone who will never develop symptoms or someone who is in the pre-symptomatic stage of infection. Next slide. With regard to the clinical course, next slide, for those who do develop symptoms, the presentation is very similar to a flu-like syndrome, with the signs and symptoms as shown on this slide and the relative percentages. One unique aspect is the peculiar loss of smell and taste, which precedes the onset of respiratory symptoms and can often linger beyond the time of the resolution of the rest of the syndrome. Next slide. Again, for those who do develop symptoms, about 81% are mild to moderate and about 15 to 20% are severe and critical, leading to a case fatality rate of anywhere from 2 to 3% up to about 20% in those who require respiratory assistance, such as mechanical ventilation. Next slide. For the people who get an increased risk of severe illness, that's older adults, people of any age with certain underlying conditions, particularly obesity, diabetes, hypertension, and chronic lung and cardiovascular disease. Next slide. When those do get severe manifestation, it is generally dominated by the acute respiratory distress syndrome. But as we've accumulated more clinical experience, it's clear that there are neurological disorders, cardiac and kidney disease, pathogenic processes such as hypercoagulability with microthrombi in small vessels, and a hyperinflammatory syndrome, usually in the course of the disease when it is far advanced. Children can experience a multisystem inflammatory syndrome, very reminiscent to a syndrome called Kawasaki's disease described many years ago. Next slide. There is post-COVID conditions, some that are easily explainable by residual organ system damage, and others which have signs and symptoms that last anywhere from weeks to months following the clearing of the acute syndrome and are characterized by signs and symptoms that are not explainable by a readily apparent pathogenic process. And this includes extreme fatigue, often induced by exercise, muscle aches, unexplained tachycardia, sleep disturbances, and something referred to as brain fog or an inability to focus or concentrate one's thoughts. Next slide. These are some of the commonly reported signs and symptoms of post-COVID conditions. Again, these are all unexplainable by identifiable laboratory abnormality or identifiable pathogenic process. Next slide. Now we'll just spend a moment or two on therapeutics. Next slide. They divide it into two components. One is to treat the virus itself. We have an FDA approved intravenously administered antiviral called remdesivir. I'll get to others in a moment. A number of monoclonal antibodies have shown to be highly effective in both treatment and prevention of this disease. And there are a number of others that are used late in the course of disease to moderate the host responses, such as the commonly used dexamethasone and a number of other products that interfere with the inflammatory cascade. Next slide. However, most recently, we have put a major effort into targeting vulnerable targets on the SARS-CoV-2 replication cycle and designing drugs to inhibit these vulnerable targets. Next slide. This slide may look confusing, but it really is simple. The big circle is a cell in the body. The small circles are the virus. When the virus enters the cell, It goes through multiple processes for its self-propagation. These are shown in the yellow highlight. One can design inhibitors, for example, of the enzyme protease, which the virus needs to replicate, or polymerase, which the virus also needs to replicate. Next slide. Using this process, a number of drugs, the most important of which have been identified to directly block the virus. One in particular is Paxlovid, which is a protease inhibitor developed by Pfizer, which in a clinical study of a placebo-controlled trial showed a remarkable almost 90% reduction in hospitalization or death compared to placebo. Next slide. Now let's turn to vaccines. If there is one success story associated with this outbreak, it's the development of safe and highly effective vaccines in an unprecedented short period of time. Next slide. In fact, this has prompted Science Magazine to deem the development of COVID-19 vaccines as the science breakthrough of the year among all scientific accomplishments in that year. Next slide. So now we have a number of highly successful vaccines, three separate platforms. You're all familiar with the mRNA, but there's also vector platforms and recombinant proteins. There have been a number of companies involved with the development of vaccines in the United States. One is already fully approved, the BioNTech mRNA. The Moderna mRNA is up to get an emergency use authorization and has it now waiting for a full BLA. J&J has an emergency use authorization, and others are in line with applications for EUA, which stands for emergency use authorization. Next slide. This success has been complicated, not obviated at all, but complicated by the appearance of different variants. Next slide. The variant that is now dominating the picture, but will soon be overtaken, as I'll mention in a moment, is the Delta variant. Next slide. Which up until recently had more than 95% of the isolates that were sequenced in the United States were Delta. Next slide. Over 175 countries have dominant variant of Delta. But as we know, this has changed. Delta was very important, next slide, because it is very transmissible, two times more transmissible than the previous Alpha variant, with very high viral loads isolated from the upper airway, which explains its increased transmissibility. Next slide. But most recently, the world has been shocked by the appearance of a variant that is even more transmissible than the very troublesome Delta variant. First isolated in Southern Africa, it is now dominating in Africa, has taken over in England, and right now, as I speak to you, in the United States, more and more of the isolates that are being identified and sequenced are of Omicron. Next slide. The reason why it is so formidable, these two rather complicated looking structures are the spike protein of the virus. On the left is the Delta variant, and on the right is the Omicron. The little lines that are coming out with letters like D614G and T547K, those are amino acid substitutes that are resulting from mutations. Note the extraordinarily larger number of mutations on Omicron, which has made it very difficult in transmissibility, in evasion of immune response, as well as the possibility of pathogenesis. Next slide. So if you look at all of these three questions, we know that it is highly transmissible. And I'm going to show you some data on each of these. Next slide. This is the rolling 7-day average of cases in South Africa beginning in the very end of November, when South Africa was relatively quiescent in the number of cases. And then seemingly out of nowhere, there was almost a vertical spike. We know now that that's all Omicron. Next slide. This is a heat map, which looks blurry, but it really tells us something very important. Go left. The peach color represents Delta. And going from left to right are the months, April, May, June, July, August, September, October. In the middle of the summer, Delta went down and you had a number of other variants represented by these different colors. And then all of a sudden, the blue color on the far right spiked up and completely blew everything else off the scene. So now it's all Omicron in South Africa. Next slide. The same is true in Denmark. I just got off the phone this morning with my colleagues in the United Kingdom. They're seeing the same thing, increasing dominance by Omicron. Next slide. Now, we've done neutralization studies as well as looking at the clinical impact of what happens when you boost an individual over their two doses of, for example, an mRNA. Next slide. Focus only on the purple bar that says Omicron. 21 days after the second dose of an mRNA, the protection, which is on the vertical axis, which stands for pseudovirus neutralizing titer, which is a long way of saying the ability of your antibodies to neutralize the virus. It's markedly diminished with Omicron. But when you go to the right, which is 1 month after the third booster shot, notice how the purple bar reconstitutes right back up with the other variants, indicating the necessity for boosting to get optimum protection. Next slide. The same holds true here when you look at neutralization and what happens when you boost. You see the blue square of triangles where it says 1 month and 5 months after a two-dose vaccine. Look what happens to those blue lines when you get the boost. The protection against Omicron goes from minimal on the left under 1 month, 5 months, to maximal on the right under booster. Next slide. The same thing holds true here. When you look at 2 weeks post a dose two, the level of antibody to Omicron in the blue shade is very low, almost undetectable. 2 weeks after the boost, it goes right back up to a highly protective level. Next slide. We've done selected clinical studies. Next slide. If you look here, the effectiveness against the virus with the Omicron wave diminishes to about 33% against hospitalization. It's still around 70%, but that's a rather serious drop from the 93% in the pre-Omicron stage. Next slide. However, we know when you boost, you can dramatically diminish that impediment of protection. So what this slide shows you, if you look at the tan shaded line, those are people who have gotten the two-dose mRNA without a boost. What they're measuring is the hazard ratio of getting a significant mortality. On the blue line is what happens with the boost. It almost brings down to undetectable that level of mortality. Next slide. and showing here the same thing. When you look at the red circles, the Omicron, it goes way down after the second boost, but look on the far right, after the booster shot, it goes right back up, comparable to the Delta. Next slide. So what's the bottom line of what I've been telling you about Omicron? It compromises the effects of a two-dose vaccine against protection of overall infection, but you still maintain some protection against severe disease. And everything I've showed you about in vitro and clinical studies indicate that boosters are critical in reconstituting protection. And our booster vaccine regimens work. And we don't think there's a need for a variant-specific booster. And that's the reason why you hear me and my colleagues speak so often about the importance of booster shots. Next slide. So what about the risk of Omicron superimposed upon Delta? Clearly, as shown on the left, the unvaccinated have a high risk. But as you go from fully vaccinated to fully vaccinated plus boosted, you can see the risk of severe disease becomes extremely low compared to the unvaccinated. Next slide. And so what is the end game for as we enter 2022 and beyond? Obviously, we're not certain of it, but next slide. If you look at the different phases of an outbreak, from the bottom up, we're never going to eradicate this. We've only eradicated one virus, and that's smallpox. Elimination may be too aspirational because we've only done that with infections in which we've had a massive vaccination campaign, like polio and measles, where even though we haven't eradicated it from the planet, we still have now no cases, with few exceptions, in the United States. So next slide, what are we focusing on? We're focusing on control, namely a level of infection that isn't zero, but that with the combination of the vast majority of the population vaccinated and boosted, together with those who've recovered from infection and hopefully also boosted, that we will get a level of control that will be non-interfering with our lives, our economy, and the kinds of things we would do, namely to get back to some degree of normality. The only way we're going to get there is if we do what we've been recommending very repetitively and intensively: vaccination, booster, mitigation with masks in congregate settings. And over time, we feel confident that we will get this under control. Next slide. So I'll stop there and be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Fauci. Wow, every time I hear you talk, I feel like I'm being taken back to my college days, my biology class in college, or my advanced biology class when I was in high school. This is just an amazing time that we're in. You joined us back in April, and frankly, I got to tell you, right now it seems like we're having a very unpleasant case of deja vu. What is it? And I know you addressed this in your presentation, but what are we doing wrong?
I don't think we're doing anything wrong in the sense of big mistakes. We're dealing with an incredibly formidable virus. But if I were to pick out one thing that we as a nation are not doing optimally, it's the extraordinary situation where you have a highly effective vaccine that is very safe, and you have 50 million people in the country who refuse to get vaccinated, many of which are motivated purely by differences in political ideology, which is really unacceptable when you're in the middle of a deadly outbreak. If there ever was a time when you wanted the nation to focus on fighting the common enemy, and the common enemy is the virus, not ourselves, it is really extraordinary that we are having interference with public health principles for reasons that have nothing to do with public health.
Politico asked John Barry, and you know he's the author of The Great Influenza, how the Biden administration can practice the basic tenets of public health communication, that's, you know, planning for the worst and always telling the truth, without sowing more division and distrust in the government and in science. What do you think the answer to that question is?
Well, there is no good answer to that question. The Biden administration has been driven purely by scientific and public health principles. And for reasons that are very complicated sociologically and politically, those core public health principles are being interpreted as an encroachment upon people's freedom. And it has nothing to do with freedom. It has to do with protecting yourself and your family from a potentially deadly disease that has killed already over 800,000 Americans, but also relinquishing your societal responsibility to be part of the solution instead of part of the problem. And when someone says, well, I'm taking my own chances, it is my body, I'll worry about it, nobody should tell me that I need to get vaccinated or that I should wear a mask in an indoor setting. Well, that might be fine for you, because you have confidence that you're not going to get seriously ill, which quite frankly, hospitals are full of people who made that mistake. And so are graveyards full of people that have made that mistake. But beyond that, you just don't realize that you don't live in a vacuum. You live in a society. And if you get infected, you could transmit that to someone else who might be vulnerable, who might be an elderly person, might be someone with an underlying condition, that actually you're playing a role in transmitting that infection to them, even though you yourself are not particularly bothered by that infection. That's the reason to prevent yourself from getting infected.
I gotta tell you, I thought it was very interesting when you said that 60% of all transmissions come from those who don't have symptoms. So that means that folks could actually be carrying the virus around and not realize it, right?
Well, not only right, that's absolutely what is going on. And that's why you see case report after case report of people gathering, nobody feels sick, everybody's having a good time, and 50% of the people get infected just from that gathering, because clearly there was one or more person in that gathering who had no symptoms and had no idea that they were infected, which is the reason for wearing a mask when you are in an indoor congregate setting and you do not know the vaccination status of the people in your environment.
That's incredible. So, holiday season, everybody's traveling to see grandma and parents, for the holidays. Is it safe to gather and travel for the holidays? And are there precautions or specific steps that we should be taking before we get together for the holiday?
Yeah. Vaccination and booster is the biggest thing you can do. And when you do travel, make sure that when you are in congregate settings, like a crowded airport, that you keep your mask on at all times. When you get on the plane, it will be required that you wear a mask. But people sometimes make the mistake of taking their mask off when they're in a congregate crowded section. The other thing one can do is you can go the extra mile and get tested before you have a family gathering or a group. Get tested the day before or the day of getting together. But vaccinated and boosted people, when the family members are vaccinated, should feel very comfortable in getting together and enjoying a holiday meal or a holiday get together.
I think many people want to go the extra mile, at least I know I do, but there's a shortage of rapid tests, long lines at testing sites. I have to ask you, were we not prepared for this kind of a surge in terms of thinking about, I mean, we've talked a lot about being vaccinated, we've talked a lot about boosters, but in terms of testing, like at-home testing, rapid testing, there seem to be severe limits on places to find a rapid test. I mean, you can't just walk into CVS now and see them on the shelf. They're kind of hard to come by.
Well, that's correct. But if you look at what things were like a year ago, it's infinitely better now than it was, but it's still not where we want it to be. You have to admit that.
Right.
The government has now put out 10,000 centers that are giving away free tests, have invested $3 billion to make 200 million to 500 million tests available per month. That's gone a long way, but you're absolutely correct. It's spotty. In some places, you can easily get a test, but in other places, you can't. And I know that. I've tried myself.
Yeah. So in my mind, I'm thinking if there are, how many testing sites did you just say?
10,000.
10,000. So is there a Google map that posts where those 10,000 testing sites are? Is there a .gov site that, you know, where people can go to find out where their nearest testing site is?
You know, I know you can go online to CVS and Walgreens, and they will tell you whether they have tests in stock and when you can get them.
Okay.
That's easy to do.
Do you think that the White House might invoke the Defense Production Act to produce more tests? Or have you suggested that to the president?
No, because they've already essentially put billions of dollars to do just that. And when companies are going at full speed, the Defense Production Act can't make them go at more full speed than they're already going. The Defense Production Act, it tells you, you know, drop everything else and do this.
Right.
But they're already dropping everything else and doing this.
You know, as I was preparing for this interview, folks were asking me to ask you lots and lots of different questions. And I had lots of parents send in questions about being concerned about vaccinating their kids and kids that are aged 2 through 5 years old. The most recent situation with the low dose Pfizer vaccine didn't come back with the best of results. How close are we to finding an effective vaccine for that 2 to 5 year old age group?
Well, we know we have an effective vaccine. I can guarantee you it's going to be effective. The critical issue that's delaying things is that when you went from the adult to the adolescent to the child, the dose was diminished. So if you take Pfizer, it was 30 micrograms for the adults. Then when it went down to 12, it was, I mean, 5 to 11, it was one third of that, which was one third of that, which was 10. And then it went down to 3 for the very young group, which was 6 months to 24 months. It looked good in that group, but that lower dose of 3 micrograms did not bring the level of antibody in the group from 2 years old to 4+ to the level where you wanted it to be. So the company decided that they believe that this is really a 3-dose vaccine, and there's no doubt that if you do give 3 doses, you're going to get an effective and safe vaccine. But they haven't proven it yet. So that's the delay. So that's the reason why I say we already know that this is going to be effective, but you've got to prove it, that it's safe and effective at a certain dose. Unfortunately, that is not going to be taking place until the end of the first quarter of 2022. So instead of getting vaccines for children from 6 months to 4 years plus, in the beginning of 2022, it likely will not be for a few months into 2022.
Wow. The other thing I found interesting is that I did not realize, and I don't think a lot of adults realize, that you get your child vaccinated for 15 vaccine-preventable diseases when they're just an infant or like into their toddler years. Do you think that, and I'm kind of going off topic on this because of so many of these kinds of questions I receive from parents. Do you think that parents actually realize the number of vaccines that their babies and children are already receiving? And if maybe we like reiterated that, it would make them more open to having their kids vaccinated now?
Well, we do that all the time. I remind parents all the time that we vaccinate children with a large number of vaccines to prevent diseases that kill fewer children than COVID does. So it almost doesn't make any sense. You're reluctant to have your child be vaccinated against SARS-CoV-2 to prevent COVID, but yet you get vaccinated against any of a number of diseases that actually have a lower mortality than COVID.
You know, you mentioned, and I'm going to address this to some folks who I'm related to who are saying that they don't want to be boosted, that they don't need to be boosted. But I thought it was very interesting that you mentioned that one of the main ways that it spread is through exercising and singing. Can you address some?
Time out. Okay. I'm an exerciser. Okay. Don't say exercise.
Okay.
In a gymnasium.
Yes, in a gymnasium. Okay. So, you know, that and what other common things that we're doing that, you know, increase the spread of the virus?
Yeah, I mean, it's very, very clear. I mean, one is it being in a gym. And the reason is that there are studies that have been done. If you cough and sneeze, you put a lot of virus out. But since most people are without symptoms who spread it, apropos of what I told you about the 60%,
right?
The louder you speak, the more you sing, the more you get out of breath when you're in a gym and there's closed space as opposed to outside. That's the reason why exercising in a gymnasium is an increased risk. Singing in a chorus or a choir inside without masks is kind of tough to sing with masks on. So you take your mask off and that puts you at a higher risk. So those things are well documented.
What else, though, besides that? Is there anything else that we commonly do that is potentially leading to more spread?
No, I mean, I think just poor ventilation is the critical issue. That's the reason why you hear us talking about if you can do something conceivably outdoors rather than indoors, do so. That becomes progressively more difficult when you're going into the dead of winter. I mean, in the fall, when you had warm days, you could actually do that. But now it's going to be tough, particularly if you live in the northern part of the country, to be able to do many things outdoors as we get into December, January, and February.
I know you addressed this in your presentation, but if you can just once again talk about what it is that makes the Omicron variant so much more contagious and address how much more contagious it is than Delta. And if you can in a very layman's sense, because I'm getting questions from folks who aren't quite following some of the presentation.
Okay, the part of the virus that binds to your receptors in your nose has a thing called the spike protein. It sort of sticks out like this, okay, and it binds to your cell. The mutations in that spike protein that Omicron has makes it much more readily binding to the receptors in your nose and in your throat and in your lung. So it's configured that it's much more efficient, that when it spreads and gets into your nose, it sticks to the receptor and infects you. That is the reason. So here is the virus.
Right.
This little squiggly here is the spike protein. If I blow this up a lot, it looks like this. And this is the part that binds to the receptor in your nasopharynx. When the mutations make this much easier to bind, then you get a much more transmissible virus. It's as simple as that.
Gotcha. So there are things on the market, you know, where people use to clean out their nasal passages and things like that. Do any of those things help?
No.
Okay. Why? No. Why don't they
help? Goggling doesn't help either.
Okay. Point taken. Yes, it doesn't. So let's talk about travel restrictions. Is it time to reinstitute travel restrictions again? We heard this morning that Israel put the United States back on its no travel list. There have been suggestions that we close the borders with Canada and Mexico again. What are your thoughts on that?
No, I think when you get to the point when there's enough of a virus in your own country, it doesn't really make any sense of trying to keep it out, because this is spreading so rapidly right now that input from countries that might even have less infection than we have, it doesn't give you any added value. In the beginning, if you want to buy some time when you have very little, if any, in your own country, which is what we did with the Southern African countries, to give us a chance to regroup and figure out what was going on, that made sense. We likely are going to pull back on that pretty soon, because we have enough infection in our own country and we're letting in people from other countries that have as much or more infection than the Southern African countries.
So
likely we are going to look at that very carefully, see if we're going to pull back on that.
So why does the United States have more deaths from coronavirus than any of the other countries in the world globally?
Well, there's a lot of reasons for that. One is that we have somewhat of a fractured healthcare system. It isn't uniformly accessible. We have a great disparity. Brown and black people, for any of a number of reasons, don't have access, have underlying medical conditions more so than others that leads to hospitalization and death. We don't see that in countries like Denmark or in other Scandinavian countries, or even countries like the UK, which have a very uniform healthcare delivery system.
So what do we do to overcome that?
It's going to take decades. We've got to straighten out our healthcare delivery system, and we've got to get rid of the clear health disparities that we have among minority populations.
What might an end to the pandemic look like?
Well, as I showed on the last two slides, it's not going to be eradication, and it's likely not going to be elimination. It's going to be a level of low level of infection that really doesn't interfere with our way of life, with our economy, with our ability to move around in society, with our ability to do things in closed indoor spaces. We will get there. I hope it's in the next several months. I never predict, because you never can get it right with this unpredictable, and sure enough, somebody will come back and say, you said this in December and you were wrong. So we don't know. We don't know.
Okay. Do you think that the virus, I mean, you kind of answered this, but is it just going to hang around and be seasonal like the flu, and we'll be getting, boosters like for the rest of our lives? Or
we don't know. I don't think we can say that. Yeah. It is possible that the third shot boost of an mRNA and maybe an additional one might give you a level of immunity that's durable. Right now, we know that two shots, the immunity goes down after 6 months or so. It's not durable. We don't know how durable that third shot booster is going to make it. And we just have to wait and see.
Okay. I have a question from a woman. She is asking, can the vaccine for the virus bring on early menopause or delay it in women?
No.
No. Okay.
No.
No.
Yeah.
All right.
We don't need a big explanation for that. It's no.
Well, that's good. That's good. So the president is set to address the American people tomorrow, and I know your team briefed him this afternoon. Can you give us some insight into what we might hear from President Biden tomorrow?
No, because I don't want to get ahead of the president of the United States. If be patient and you will hear what he has to say. I'm sure it's going to be emphasizing some of the things that he put in his winter plan, which was emphasizing boosters, family vaccination, parents and children, testing, surge capacity, particularly sixty surging units, paying attention to contributing more to getting the rest of the world vaccinated, tightening up some of the travel issues. That's going to be in there, but he's going to give a lot more. So stay tuned tomorrow and you'll get it from the president.
Okay. I know you answered this in your presentation, but the question has come up again, so I'm going to ask it. When might we know if Omicron is more lethal than Delta? And can you go into again what some of the early symptoms are of Delta and early symptoms of Omicron, and how they're different, or if they, you know, are pretty much the same?
There's no difference. They're exactly the same. The same thing I showed you on multiple slides that I showed. You present when you do have symptoms. Many people are not without symptoms. You present with a flu-like syndrome. And then after a while, if you get to severe disease, it's mostly respiratory, but can be also other organ systems. It is unlikely it's going to be more lethal. There's some suggestive evidence from the southern African nations, particularly South Africa, that if anything, it might be a little less severe, but we don't want to hang our hat on that for the simple reason is that might be due to the fact that there are so many people in South Africa who've been previously infected with Delta and Beta that they have a degree of residual immunity that's not protecting them against infection, but is protecting them against severity of disease. So unlikely that it's going to be more severe. Possibly it might be less severe.
What's your advice to those unable to have boosters because of severe reactions that they've had to, like, the Pfizer vaccine?
I would try another vaccine. That's one of the good things about having multiple choices. So if you had a severe reaction to J&J, I would try an mRNA and vice versa.
Given the recent recommendation against J&J as a booster, as well as studies of its antibody response to Omicron, should people who have had at least one J&J shot be considered for a fourth shot of an mRNA vaccine?
No, I think if they get a J&J and then get boosted either with J&J or, as the CDC recommends, get boosted with an mRNA, they should get their level up that's comparable to the other who are boosted.
And before I go to thanking some people who got you to do this today for us, I want to ask you about right here in Washington, D.C., Mayor Bowser had initially lifted the indoor mandate, and now she's restored it. And do you think that, like, in places like D.C., larger cities, Chicago, that it would be prudent for them to institute, like, the things that they do in New York and Los Angeles, where you have to show your vaccination card to get into places?
You know, that's an individual choice. That's one of the things about our country. It isn't driven centrally, it's locally. New York made a choice. I think it was a prudent choice about making sure people are vaccinated before they go in. I think that's a good idea, but I think it's going to be left up to the local jurisdictions to make that decision.
Well, before I ask the final question, I'd like to thank the organizers of today's event, Headliners co-team leaders Donna Linewan and Lori Russo, today's Headliner event coordinator Bill Pierce. I like to call him the Fauci Whisperer because we can only manage to get Dr. Fauci when Bill's involved. Club membership director Kate Helster and club executive director Bill McCarron. I'd also like to shout out the fantastic team behind me in our Broadcast Operations Center. I could not do this without them. You should know that here at the National Press Club, we will continue bringing you quality newsmakers in 2022, including a discussion with the Prime Minister of one of my favorite places, Aruba, on January 10th, and a headliner panel of democracy advocates who will take a look at changing state election laws and what those changes mean for voters. We'll be having that discussion on January 13th. So please plan to join us for that. So I have multiple final questions for you, Dr. Fauci. Okay. I wanted to do a holiday rapid round with you, but I couldn't come up with all of the different fun things for the holidays. And, I like to end on something light. So going back to the early days, whose impersonation of you did you prefer? Kate McKenna's or Brad Pitt's?
Without a doubt, Brad Pitt.
Okay.
I think Kate's was much more funny, but Brad was terrific.
Okay.
So I like Brad Pitt's.
That's cool. And how have you managed to keep going at full speed? I know you said that you exercise, and I watched the piece that CBS did with you, the interview, and you talked a lot about, your walks and all of that. But how do you keep going at such full speed? And are you getting enough sleep?
Well, answer the first question. You just focus on what your job and your mission is. And that really gives you a lot of energy, particularly when you're dealing with such a serious situation as is now. I will take it easy and rest when this is all over, but I don't have time for that now. And I'm not getting enough sleep.
Okay. So what are you doing for Christmas? And do you have a Christmas wish?
Well, I'm going to be a very happy Christmas because my children, my three adult daughters, who I was not able to spend Christmas with last year for the first time since their birth because of how bad things were last year.
Wow.
We didn't have a vaccine and they did not want to travel from the different cities that they live in various parts of the country to come here because they did not want to endanger me. But now that I'm vaccinated and boosted and my wife is vaccinated and boosted and all the kids are vaccinated and boosted and tested,
okay,
we feel very comfortable about having a nice, quiet Christmas Eve, Christmas Day together. My Christmas wish, I think, is obvious that this thing ends very quickly and that we put aside all the political, ideological nonsense that gets in the way of our really doing a full, good public health job and get everybody who can be vaccinated and get this thing ended. That's my wish.
Yeah, it's a wish for the entire globe, I think, at this stage. And I will end on one final holiday question. Eggnog, fruitcake, what do you like? What's your favorite holiday treat? What do you look forward to at the holidays that maybe your wife makes or someone in your family makes? People want to know.
I already did it last night. I made my favorite Italian pasta dish called timpano. Did you ever see The Big Night with Stanley Tucci?
I have not.
That movie? Yeah, you got to go see that. It's great. He made this incredible dish that I copied from him, and I make it every Christmas holiday.
So what's in timpano?
So, you get ziti, mozzarella, ricotta, sausage. You get it, mix it all up, and you make it in sort of on crew. You put a dough around it and it becomes out like a big drum. And instead of eating it like you eat pasta, you cut it into sections.
Ooh.
And eat it. Fantastic.
Ooh, that's...
Yeah, I stole the recipe from Stanley Tucci.
Well, all righty then. That sounds like a great recipe. And I think I'm going to steal it from you. I might not have it for the holidays, but it sounds like a great recipe. And I got to tell you, we really appreciate you joining us today. We know that you spend a lot of time doing interviews for folks, but you're also spending a lot of time in the lab. And we really, really appreciate you. I had folks actually describe you as an American hero. We are very grateful for your service and very grateful for your appearance here at the National Press Club. And I don't have a mug with me right now, but you know the drill. You will be receiving the coveted National Press Club mug in the mail. And I wish you all the very best for the holidays and the new year, Dr. Fauci.
Thank you very much. Same to you. Enjoy the holiday. Good to see you.
Good to see you.
My pleasure.
Merry Christmas.
You too. Thanks.